I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders Live. In the My Seven Wonders podcast, I ask a special guest to select and talk about the seven wonders of his or her world. This episode is one of several we recorded in front of a live audience at the 2022 Edinburgh Festival Fringe. The guest for this recording is a very popular comedian who's been a regular performer at the Edinburgh Fringe for many years, and an irregular performer on all sorts of panel shows, comedy programmes, on TV and radio. He's also a novelist who's published half a dozen titles already. So here we are with an enthusiastic Edinburgh Fringe audience exploring the seven wonders of Mark Watson.
So you're doing a show here, so I'll be polite enough to mention that, if I may. So what's your show called this year?
The show's called This Can't Be It, and it's... I had almost the opposite. I was very much more fortunate than you in that I began to tour this show before everything happened. Then it was put on long hiatus, of course. This is sort of, in a way, the farewell month for this. I do have quite a few tour dates still to come, actually. So I've been really enjoying it. I'm not... Well, it's my day off today, theory, but my children are here. So, as you'll be aware, it's by no definition a day off, really. No. And by here, I mean they're literally watching this, which puts an extra layer of pressure on
it. Do they often see you? Are they fans, or are they here, you know, under sufferance?
It's a bit of both. I think they... they have voluntarily watched the last three nights of the show from the wings, so I suppose that makes them fans. But on the other hand, if I just left them somewhere, that would be abuse. So I think you have to say it's fandom, but under degree of pressure.
One up from abuse. Making them suffer your comedy every night.
I've had them up on stage a couple of times for the audience to applaud them, but even that is the sort of thing that might be mentioned to a therapist in 10 years' time. I accept that,
Now, you sometimes do marathon shows, like 24-hour shows.
I have done that quite a few times here.
I think you've done it in London as well, but what got you going doing that? Was that for charity purposes or just the challenge to see
the stupid thing is, it wasn't even for charity. The most recent two or three were for Comic Relief in London, and those were proper fundraising efforts. But no, the genesis of the idea was, of course, here. The Fringe is the only place you'd come up with something like this and try and do it. I think this is a long time ago now, 18 years ago, the first one. And it was quite simply that I thought, I had come here as a student, and then there's a very young comedian, and I found it very heady, the atmosphere of experimentation and adventure. And I just sort of thought, why has no one ever done a 24-hour show before? And it became one of those things where you think, now I've had the idea, I've got to do it, or someone else will take it. But actually, I realise now, no one else wanted to. No. There's a good reason why no one's done it. It's physically and mentally punishing. But it became odd. The first one got quite a lot of attention in the way these fringe things do, and it became an annual tradition. And I stopped doing it quite a long time ago, then rekindled the idea in London. But in 2 years, in 2024, it'll be the 20th anniversary of the first one of these. So I almost certainly can't resist revisiting the idea.
Oh, excellent. Well,
although it's sort of a young man's game. I'll be 44 by then, and I might have quite a few regrets.
44 is still young, isn't it? Can I get a consensus in the room?
I forgot about the likely demographic here. Yes, I am. My kids are doing us all a favour, lowering the average age significantly. Yeah,
kind of depends upon people having a vague idea who I am. And that is a... There is a skew in the age function, though. I meet a lot of fans around. Well, I meet a lot of children or grandchildren of fans of mine walking around Edinburgh.
Even at my age, people more commonly say, my mum likes you than I like you. And I don't know what to make of it, really.
Yeah, well, meet the mum. Now, the...
you can't always, though.
Yeah. because your children, so. So let's start with your first wonder. You've provided me the list of wonders, so I'll just... tee you off if I may. So the first one, it's a It's an interesting list of wonders.
Yeah, broadly speaking, I have gone for sort of a geographical spread of wonders. I've taken it fairly literally, I think.
Okay,
yeah.
All right, okay. So your first one is Adelaide Hills Wineries.
Yeah, so,
did you have an interesting experience in Australia once on a tour?
Before you began the pandemic, I used to travel quite a lot, and that is just coming back now. And two or three of my choices are sort of Australian flavoured, because it's where I've spent some of my happiest times. Mm. Yeah, specifically, I first went there as a young comedian, a young man, and I'd never been on a winery's tour or even to a winery. And yeah, another comedian just said to me, we're just going to go around all these places, and everywhere you go, you could just demand as much free wine as you want. Mm. And all you have to do in exchange is listen to them talk about it.
Yeah.
And it seemed too good to be true, yeah. But sure enough, that was basically the size of it. So one of the happiest days of my life at the time. I looking back, though, the other guy was driving us. But I thought very recently, well, hang on, how do we get around? And there's no doubt about it. He had of course, each wine was about that size, but nonetheless... must have been about 46 of them by the end of the day. But yeah, I had no driving responsibilities. In fact, I still don't drive. And I won't say that's entirely because of my enthusiasm for wineries, but it is a contributing factor.
Yeah, sure.
I think that one of the most, if you are a wine drinker, one of the most, at the time, I had absolutely no idea of, you know, about wine as an industry or the different grapes, all of that kind of thing. I just knew that I liked drinking it. And 15 years on, now I'm the sort of guy who... listens and nods when they talk about leaving the skins on the grapes or the cool climate and stuff. But ultimately, I know in my heart, I'm still a guy that just really likes drinking it. And there's nothing quite like doing it in Australia, I think, because of the... Of course, it's largely about the booze, but there's also the grandeur of the landscapes, the beauty of it, the beautiful of the sky. So there's kind of... and I think I've also always been drawn to Australia because, I mean, it's probably quite a depressing thing to say, but it's just so far from home.
Yeah.
There's sorry, kids. Yeah. But just they're coming. They're
next time. Yeah.
They will be hopefully coming next year. Yeah. There's something I'd never done anything like it when I first went there. And so, I was only mid-20s, and I experienced this quite dizzying sense of...
So did you go out to appear at the Adelaide
it was
Comedy
the,
Festival?
Yes, Adelaide Fringe and then the Melbourne Comedy Festival. Yeah. It was my first time in Australia. And I'd never really dreamed that work would take me... so far away, obviously, and I'd never been to Australia. I was the only British person, in fact, not to go there before university. somehow managed to go not to Australia nor to Thailand, just went straight to university like a loser. So I did have this sort of complex that I'd never travelled very much, and so it was a breathtaking idea to me that just by doing this I could get to. So I was very starry-eyed about going there. Now I've now been to Australia lots of times, but I never quite lose my sense of wonder about it, I think.
This reminded me, I went to Australia before you, but, you know, when I was similar sort of age that you're talking about. And I'm not a wine expert, but I thought, oh, these Australian wines are nice, simple ones to get your head round. And I came back thinking, that's what I'm going to go for. That'll be my choice. So I went to buy some Australian wine, and I said, I don't know if you'd have Australian wine. And he said, yeah, there's a huge section over there. Everybody's drinking Australian wine. And I was accidentally just absorbing the fashion of the time, because it's, you know, it is everywhere now. So that was another...
Yeah. Although what we have is still quite relatively cheap Australian wines.
Yes.
One lesson you'll know if you've been to Australia, almost all their good stuff they keep.
Yeah.
They, the worst Australian beer, Foster's, is the one that they've successfully convinced us is what everyone drinks. You'll remember the enormous con in the 80s where the whole British public was convinced that Australians either drink Foster's or Castlemaine. Wouldn't give a 4X for...
Yeah.
But I've barely met an Australian that would go near Foster's, and Castlemaine 4X barely exists anymore. And mind you, not all of it is like Neighbours either. if your idea of Australia was shaped by the 80s, people come back to life far less than you would imagine from watching Neighbours. And so, yes, it's sort of the same with wines. There are all these wines like, you know, Jacob's Creek type wines, which... the bottles imply that they're the absolute prime of Australia, but again, Australians would barely touch it. The average calibre of a very cheap bottle of wine there is extraordinary, but most of it doesn't find its way here, and you can only get so much of it back in your suitcase, of course.
Okay. Yes, I'm happy buying low cost wine. That's my wine of choice. But I know that's not the connoisseur's route.
No, I'm certainly not a connoisseur. I'm not posh about it. It's just without wanting to sound too technical, because there'll be people here who perhaps are not up on wine like I am, I think the hangovers are worse with shit wine.
Yeah.
So, that informs my buying choices, Clive.
Yes, absolutely.
I didn't even come to this conclusion myself. Somebody said to me a few years ago, I said, I don't really taste a huge amount of difference between these supermarket wines and the... And the guy said to me, but you will notice a difference in the morning. And I do think now as I get older, that's probably true, unfortunately.
Yeah. Am I getting from that you feel happier in Australia? You sometimes have a... I mean, maybe it's just your comedy act. You sometimes have a sort of depressed sort of sound to occasionally. but then your eyes...
I can see you searching for a more diplomatic word than that.
Well, do you know what I mean? Some people are, other comedians are always, isn't life dreadful? And I would put you towards that end of the scale.
Yes, you'd put me in the sort of quite substantial... miserable bastard genre of comedians.
Not quite the full Jack D, but you know,
I don't think I could sustain it as long as Jack has. No, well, it's funny actually. I'd say that has been true for quite a lot of my career. I've been quite a lot perkier in my over the past couple of years.
Actually. Oh, right.
I think gradually I'm perhaps there's the worrying idea that I might be getting happier in life, but that has disastrous consequences for a comedian. Absolutely. Obviously, imagine if Jack D had suddenly perked up in his 50s.
Yes. Well, he claims that he got nowhere as a comedian until he decided he wasn't going to do it. And then he had a booking at the Comedy Store somewhere. So we went along and just said, oh, I can't stand doing it. I'm not. And everyone fell about laughing. And
I've heard him say that before. Yeah. Imagine doing that one night and then it turns out that's what people wanted for 40 years, though, or however that's happening. He might be as happy as Larry, but we'll never know.
I think he is, really.
I think I think there are certain things about Australia which do bring... I suppose all of us feel there are different... parts of the world away from home that bring another side out of you. Just the weather tends to make me cheerful, for example. Yeah. I suppose the sort of food and drinks. But of course, part of what it is that when I'm there, I'm nearly always there just as a performer. I have very few responsibilities. I don't have many holidays because I travel enough that I regard those work trips as holidays. But in practice, a lot of them are just rushing about from place to place. Whereas in Australia, I've been in the same place for maybe 3 or 4 weeks. So it's probably a lot of it is just that. But I do have a real fondness for the Australian people and the landscape and just everything about the country. Yeah.
Jolly good. Okay, well, we're moving on to your next wonder, which takes us a bit closer to home. And I'm not quite sure. Well, I'm guessing why this is on here. I can't work it out. The Old Shea Ground, Halifax.
Yes, this is quite a leap, I accept it. Yeah. Oh, Yorkshire people here.
Well, how lucky. There's a huge claque of Yorkshiremen and women in, maybe from Halifax.
It wasn't luck. I know my audience. I sent out a massive questionnaire this morning.
Yes.
You can't be from Halifax. That's a huge coincidence. No one could have expected that.
So before we get to your word, when I first saw you performing, which was a long while ago, it was actually the Hay Literary Festival.
Oh, that's right.
Came on and you were Welsh in those days.
Yeah, funny things happen over time.
Yeah. you performed as a Welsh
person. For the first few years I did, and that was something which sort of hatched here again at the Fringe.
Yeah.
I won an open mic competition. It's a little bit like the Jack D thing, actually. Yeah. I just did it as a sort of Welsh persona on a whim, and then that started to go well, and then I began being introduced as the Welsh comedian.
Yeah.
And then I remember, I think all that made me stop it really was, well, firstly, Rod Gilbert came along, and I felt as if I was stealing his life.
There've been lots of Welsh comedians.
It's true. Yeah. There's been Max Boyce had come and gone well before. I don't think he's not gone, actually.
No, he's...
no one is quite that Welsh, I suppose. But it was also, actually... You might have even been there. There was basically what started to happen was that I appeared more and more on Radio 4 and other places where, specifically, there was an episode of Loose Ends where I was on, and you do your act. Plenty of people here will have heard Loose Ends. You perform your stand up.
So.
Yeah, surely. So I did my 5 minutes of stand up with the other acts around the table, but then there's a bit where you just chat, and I had to maintain the Welsh accent during that, and this was happening more and more. I don't get a lift home with a comedian. Often when you start out, you're dependent on the other comedian. You go somewhere like Halifax, someone that drives everyone home.
Yeah.
And I end up talking for 3 or 4 hours in my adopted Welsh accent just to, thanks for the lift, I'll give you some petrol money. Yeah. And I start to think, well, this is, I'm living more in a lie than in reality here.
Right. Yeah.
And so there was a day when I went on Radio 4, something like Loose Ends, performed in my Welsh accent and then just spoke in my normal voice, and there were quite a lot of I don't exactly complaint, but there were confused listener feedback after that. Yeah. And so I started to think it probably is time to retire this. Otherwise, I'll be in the Jack D situation. Mm. I'll still be doing it. It was a very easy accent for me to adopt because a lot of my family are from Wales, but you can't. You don't want to do that for your whole life.
No, okay. Well, I'm disturbed. You obviously remember being on Loose End. You can't remember if it was me or Ned Sheeran presenting at the time, but which is fair enough. And that bit when a comedian did a few minutes, I got rid of on that because I thought that was the worst gig to give a comedian to perform to. It might be about 20 people.
I think I did it. First was definitely Ned Sheeran because I couldn't believe I was meeting him. And then I think it was with you. And you're right. By then it was just a chat.
Yes.
And it was much better. Yeah. Yeah, nothing's odder really than doing stand-up to literally six people. Yeah. And there's always a band there as well.
Yes.
You'd see the band. Yeah. The band with the best will in the world are probably not going to laugh that much. So they're tuning their instruments.
Well, we often have, you know, musicians from Mali or Japan or somewhere, so they're not always the most receptive audience.
They might not be big on a joke about the Big Breakfast or something.
Yeah, So I think your mother's Welsh, and
I grew up in Bristol, in fact, almost in Wales.
Yeah.
Although an important distinction as far as Bristolians is concerned.
But Bristolian accent is a popular accent for comedians and comedy as well. So you could have switched between the two. You could have done a bit more. More Bristol, and then
that's
then,
right. Yeah, yeah. Because my dad is neither from Bristol nor Wales, I didn't. I think my accent sort of comes from him. I didn't really pick up much of a natural. There's occasional Bristolian tang that comes in. If I'm in Bristol, I become more Bristolian.
Oh, of course,
and if I'm at the football or doing some other Bristolian thing, I suddenly to a degree, which is quite embarrassing, actually.
All right. Well, we've got to get back to Halifax, though. So this is not Bristol. It's not Wales. It's not Edinburgh. You haven't mentioned Halifax until we get to this one, but why?
In fact, my experience of performing in Halifax has been quite limited. I've only done two shows there. The first one was with Russell Howard, and both of us were very young comedians at the time. And it was one of my first ever gigs in Yorkshire, in fact. And I had this idea in my head that it'd be rough, that I would be regarded with suspicion as a southerner. So I was pacing up and down, thinking, "Don't let yourself down." In those days, you do a lot of early career. You do a lot of sort of rougher club gigs as well. I can't remember the name of the place, but it did seem quite intimidating. So it's just like walking up and down, getting more and more frantic. My name was called, walked on, thinking, "Be confident, look rough." In fact, I'd given myself a nosebleed and it was all over me. And so I walked on stage, felt the audience gasp, looked down, absolutely covered in blood. And it was quite a memorable gig.
Yes. And they wouldn't know whether you'd been hit as you came up or it was part of a comedy skit. It's a bit like his Welsh accent. He puts it on sometimes.
I did nearly claim it had happened on the way there, like comedians do. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the end, almost the whole gig was about that. And by the end, I think I'd convinced them it was real blood. Mm. Not the sort of act you can replicate many times, though, I have to say. The Shea Ground is now called the Shea Stadium. Was a football ground in Halifax, Halifax Town's stadium.
Yes.
And I'm an enormous football fan, but I have specific enthusiasm for old football stadiums. Very often I will go and visit the football ground of a town. I mean, even if there's not a game there, just to see it.
Yeah.
And obviously, a lot of stadia now are built out of town and they're a bit more, not exactly soulless, but they're sort of bigger and more corporate seeming. But there are still a few of these grounds around that are kind of crumbling and have old style terraces and old advertising, but also have a very large collection of football programmes. It's the same sort of appeal, this taste of a world that's gone, you know, cigarette adverts or adverts for coach tours, long defunct
Bovril,
all this sort of thing. I have a real sentimental fondness.
Peeing down the terraces at half time.
Yes, weeing in someone else's pocket. Yeah, the golden days. Yeah.
Literally.
I took my son, who's now 12, but when he was about 8, I took him to a football match at a non-league ground where you still could get Bovril.
Yeah.
And he asked what it was, and I said, it's a beef drink, basically. And he literally just wouldn't believe me.
No.
I had to get one to prove it to him.
Melted cow.
Yeah. Exactly. This is melted cow. Yeah. One or a Coke.
Yeah.
And this already is no longer there. It's been rebuilt. But when I first went to Halifax to play, it was about 2010 or something. Halifax's club had gone out of business and the ground was just there, you might remember, just a ghost of a football ground that had been there for 70, 80 years. And it was snowing, it was December, so I stood, it was an obviously mad thing to do, no one had visited for years, but I went out in the snow and just stood on this ancient terrace thinking about the people that congregated there for decades, generations of people, many of them, to be fair, in flat caps. And I felt that's what's in it for me, really, with old stadiums, the sense of how much... Yes. The same way some people feel about visiting a Roman amphitheatre, and I do, actually. But it's... This is the reason I chose it is, as I say, it's now a bit rebuilt. Halifax, as a club, are back on their feet.
Yeah.
So now you would just see a sort of generic lower league ground there. But for about 10 years, there was this, as I say, phantom place there. And I'd happened to be there during that window. So it's a sort of... It's one of my seven wonders because it no longer exists in that form, basically.
Can I just check with our, party in from Yorkshire? Does any of this make sense? Is there a ground? Is it crumbling? Or what's happening to it now? Yeah, just like you said.
Yeah,
I didn't want it.
They managed to reform the club with mostly public, like fans' money. Actually, so it is a happy story that they
it's back in business. Again.
They came back from the dead as a club, but obviously it was kind of magical to see this this abandoned football ground. Mostly they get sold off and turned into IKEAs and things like that. But if you can grab them, there's sometimes a ghost ground there just for a couple of years, and it is quite a thing if you're a football fan to observe.
I shouldn't put in my stories as well, particularly, but it did remind me of I once went on a trip with my father to Glen Buck in Ayrshire, which used to have does anyone know about the Glen Buck cherry pickers? Yeah. Yeah, all right, there you are. See, so to give you an idea of what the sort of holidays I had as a child,
they were labour basically.
No, we stayed. Me and my father stayed with my ex infant school teacher, Mrs. Willock, who lived in Alloway in Ayrshire. I don't know why we spent some time. She was retired.
I was going to ask.
No, I know, but it's a complicated story. Anyway, we went on a trip to see Glen Buck, which used to produce. It was a mining village, and it produced loads and loads of great footballers. Including, as it happens, Bill Shankly, who are the Liverpool manager, and his brother, who was another manager. But there, all we could see was a field. The mining thing was gone. There was a school still being used to store straw and agricultural products like that. And the whole village, apart from three houses, had completely disappeared. And I was... this is where all these footballers came from, most of whom I had never heard of. But so that for me lodges in my mind as it was all misty. You know, a man came out of the mist and said he remembered the Shankleys, and they all lived over there, and that crumbled down.
He would have been paid to do that.
Yeah,
he said it three times.
Has anyone else gone to see Glen Buck? Anyway, if we had a party from Glen Buck as well as.
Then it would start to look suspicious.
Yes,
then,
it would. Yeah.
Yes, there is something about these places where. That have history written into them, but you can no longer quite reach out and touch it, but you sense it. There's something special about that.
Talking of history and touching it, which in fact you can't, but we're going on to your next wonder, which is a more obvious wonder, dare I say, than a football ground in Halifax. It's Stonehenge.
Yes, I thought I'd go for at least one sort of widely acknowledged wonder
of
the world.
Yes,
and again, it is sort of tinged with. I'm melancholy, don't want to keep painting myself into this gloomy old bastard corner.
Yeah.
But as you say, you can't touch it anymore. And Stonehenge was somewhere that I grew up in Bristol, not far away, and you'd occasionally glimpse it from the road. But I never visited it until the present time when, of course, you can't get very close to the stones.
No.
And you are kind of herded round it in quite... So even though I found it... it was a fulfilment of an ambition to go there, but it was somehow less magical than I felt as if it might have been.
Yes.
I'd read, is it either Tess of the D'Urbervilles or Judy? I think it is Tess, where they just stumble upon Stonehenge.
Yeah.
And that idea was magical, and I'd seen photos of it, and the idea that you might just kind of come upon Stonehenge in the night like they do in that book, it fascinated me. But of course, the pragmatic reality of it now is quite different. I still enjoyed visiting it, but I couldn't help thinking this is now a tourist experience I'm having, and there was a time when you could just do this.
Well, there was a time when it wasn't really protected, so people could stumble on it, and they could also damage it and write their initials on it, things like that.
This is the thing, of course. You can see why it's protected now, but you do lose a piece of why people wanted to see it in the first place.
I think there might even be a sort of Thomas Hardy was here or written somewhere, but
this is the trouble, isn't it? It's an interesting question whether it is more magical preserved, as it were, in amber now, or whether we ought to have let it kind of gradually decline, but at least it would still be what it always was.
Declined quite a lot, but do you?
Yeah, again, I never saw it.
Do you go when you go to see Stonehenge or any other sort of standing stones around the country? Do you get a feeling of an association with things from thousands of years ago?
Yeah, but it's quite difficult. It's quite a difficult emotion to access, isn't it? I've travelled back and forth to the west a lot, and you often see that Westbury white horse, or there's two or three of those in fact. And again, there's something really magical about both all of these sites of our kind of our pagan past, our ancestry, but exactly what you're meant to feel, I'm never quite sure, really. Yeah. Beyond, oh, that's cool, there's that horse again.
Yeah.
I feel as if the sight of something that is hundreds or thousands of years old ought to stir more in you than it does. It's just very difficult to, you always feel sort of intellectually at one remove from it, basically. Yeah. It's absolutely fascinating that Stonehenge was constructed in the way it must have been, and that it is a remnant of a past that we're so removed from. Yeah. So basically, yes, there is something stirs in you when you see these things, but it's very hard to know what to think apart from, well, that's really old, isn't it? I think it's so old that it's sort of incomprehensible. Again, my brain can just about stand on the terraces of an old football ground and think people have been coming here for 70 years, 100 years. When it becomes thousands of years, it's very difficult for your brain to do anything with that idea.
The great thing about Stonehenge is there's always something new that somebody comes up with. So I think almost the most recent thing is they've found the site in Wales where they think the blue stones were originally erected, and so before they were transported quite a long way, given they didn't have railways. Well, we don't anymore, but they didn't have
again, not everything changes.
Yeah. They don't have mechanised things.
So no, they were there waiting for a replacement bus service for days. With you can't bring that on, mate.
So what? Why was it built? Was it a burial site? Was it a gathering point? A very clumsy calendar for working out when the Midsummer's Day is. But
I often think if I did get a time machine, that would probably be one of my choices. Go back and watch that being constructed. But of course, probably still wouldn't make any sense of it. You still have no idea what was going on.
No, I suppose not.
It would be quite something to watch, but also it would be very, very slow. It depends how long you get in a time machine, I suppose. Yeah. You wouldn't see a lot of action per day.
No, I don't know. It might be immediate. I don't, on Family Guy, they do it straight away.
Maybe it's like a sort of fold-out tent and we don't have that technology anymore.
I did a documentary about Stonehenge not long ago. At that point, they were fairly convinced that it was sort of the last flowering of the Stone Age. That was the great sort of achievement of the stone. So it's more or less completely worked. But after that, the people were rather pushed aside by people with more efficient technology as bronze and iron came in. Yeah, and they were replaced rather than... They didn't just learn these new techniques. People with the new techniques. That's been a dispute over quite some time. They think they've now resolved
that. And that sort of makes sense, doesn't it? You can imagine people 500 years on looking at Stonehenge and thinking, oh, look at that old piece of crap, in the same way that people suddenly started pulling up carpet and restoring floorboards. Yes. Eventually everything comes back.
Yeah.
Stonehenge is a good example of something your granddad would have said, it'll come back in, you watch.
So a few thousand years later, it came back as a tourist attraction. So have you been... There's a road. Is it the A313 that goes past
Stonehenge? The 303, I think, yes.
A lot of people say, I was a bit disappointed with Stonehenge because I've looked at it from the road. But you do need to get out and park.
I have been twice to actually look at it and paid to see it and everything. Yeah. As I say, it's still well worth doing. But somehow, in a way, it's something that you envy the ancients for having seen, maybe.
Yes.
Although, on the other hand, I don't envy them most of the other stuff.
If you had a time machine, would you go forwards or backwards?
Oh, for sure. My son asked me this just the other week. I don't know if he's got one. Yeah. I sounded like a bit of a loaded question.
He's working on it.
I was on my way taking them to the dentist, so I very much wouldn't go forwards at that point, I can tell you. Absolutely, without question, backwards. Yeah, I think that I don't think there's anything to be gained by seeing what is in store either for oneself or for civilization.
It's a bit scary, I think. As
there
would have been a time when we looked forward and thought, "Oh, this would be marvelous to see all the wonderful innovations," and now we think, "Oh, will anything still be here?"
Yes, I don't necessarily. I'm not saying that things will necessarily be worse in different future epochs, but I don't think that's what I want. No, I think like everyone else, I just have a go at the Romans or medieval times or something like that. Just go to a medieval feast, one of those things.
Yeah,
the court of Richard II, I think, or something. That's my specialist area. I'd like to see Chaucer do a reading of the Canterbury Tales or something like that. Yeah,
you want to make sure you go back and you're a high up person, because I think lowly people's lives are pretty tough.
Well, that's the only thing.
Pre medicine and pre all those kind of things.
Yeah, I'd have a lot of questions over how long you stay there, whether you can definitely come back, do you look like a person from now? Because you have to field a lot of questions if not.
You look as though you could fit in pretty well in medieval times.
Emaciated, waif-like, and with a life expectancy of 35.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, let's go on to a more modern thing, really, for your fourth wonder, which is New York seen from a plane.
Yes, it doesn't have to be New York, actually, but I just thought I'd spread the landmarks around the
world. So anywhere seen from a plane.
Well,
the view from a plane.
A metropolis seen from a plane is sort of what I mean, okay. I think. And I think New York's the best example I could think of off the top of my head, because there is something absolutely dizzying about the size and scale of it. But there have been plenty of cities I haven't seen. Sydney is spectacular in a different way, but it's I think and I have also been to Tokyo, but just because of the time of day you couldn't really see anything. I have a real I sort of respond to cities in the way that some people respond to mountain ranges or things. I think I find it very moving that I know that we've caused enormous damage with our with many of our human activities, but I think there's something wonderful about landscapes, and so skyscrapers are sort of my equivalent of mountains or waterfalls, I suppose. And so obviously New York is a famous one, but I think often when you're at ground level, you're overwhelmed, but also you don't have perspective. Something about flying into land and seeing you get a sense of just how many millions of souls are collected beneath you in one snapshot, people you will never meet, and you seeing cars and trains and all of it. Seeing the swarm of human activity from a plane is a real, ironically, real grounding moment, I think, because you remember how tiny you are in the human scheme. And also the architecture of cities is fascinating. Again, on foot, you often don't get a sense of it, but from above, you can often see how cities have been planned and gradually outgrown those plans. And I love it.
I think New York has definitely got the way they build buildings, the skyscrapers. They're similar sized buildings together, and it's looked like crystalline growth, whereas other cities, well, I'm thinking, I suppose, mainly about London, where there are some great buildings, but they seem to poke up rather randomly and in a slightly disorganised
way. Yeah, London has the appearance of, from the air of what it is, basically, absolute chaos that has been built. London, because of course, of centuries and centuries of building, London is like a house that your parents have been working on. They've added more and more mad features, like a conservatory. Whereas, something like New York obviously still has that. It has that original sense of clarity and purpose, and then now the clutter and madness of a modern city. So there's something for everyone.
To me, it just looks like things that have grown on a culture of money. So the Wall Street, there's these big buildings, then further up there's another huge lot of buildings, and the lesser ones are where there's less money in it.
That's right. And I often think about what it would have been like for people, even 50 years ago, but certainly 100 years ago, to observe this, and it would have been incomprehensible. Dubai is obviously an extreme example, because you'll sometimes see, I've been to Dubai once or twice to work, and you'll see photos of 1970 where there's nothing there at all but desert, and 50 years on, this sort of almost frightening tiny metropolis. And that is seen by us as being sort of almost vulgar, the way it's grown, and as it's all powered by money. But in fact, you know, if you go back far enough, all of our cities are now dizzying size compared with the way they grew up.
So you've got quite a wide-ranging career as a comedian. You play in Australia, Dubai, Tokyo, you mentioned, maybe you go to Hong Kong. Have you also performed in New York, or is that another world?
I have not. No, I've been to the Montreal Comedy Festival, as you will have done, which is, although in Canada, it is quite American-centric festival. But New York itself, no. I've visited several times, but I've always been intimidated to actually try and get on stage there, because, as you say, it is sort of its own world. The New York comedy scene is so very discreet from ours, and so the culture of, I like New York a lot, but the culture of it feels kind of quite baffling and alien. Whereas, ironically, Melbourne is twice as far away feels very, very familiar.
Yes.
It's a challenge I do have in my mind. I'd love to do just a few minutes on stage in New York, but I think most British comics find it much odder than performing in most countries, just because the American... Yeah. This is not to call Americans insular or anything, because it is just such a sealed culture in some ways, and there's so many references. I watch American comics and I've got often almost no idea what they're on about in a way that doesn't happen with Canadians, even, or Australians or New Zealand comics.
Definitely not Australian. I think Australia just, to me, seems like it's British people, but in the sun.
Pretty much.
They don't like that, to be told that, but it's
But it almost is that. And they've all got British family, or they've been to Britain. So, exporting a British comedy show into Australia, you just have to say the same jokes, but with mate at the end of every sentence, and you're away, basically.
Well, it was a great thing in the old days, going back 30, 40 years, people would go and extend their career by going and doing series in Australia or tours and stuff.
It's been a real privilege, the amount that I've been able to, and hopefully as the world makes it possible again, I will travel. Yeah. Although, Tokyo was a holiday. I'm not sure how well I'd go over there.
Well, there seem to be English-speaking people in most parts of the world. So Dubai, presumably you're playing to expats.
I've been
British.
To Dubai several times to play to expats who... and I don't wish to stereotype the sort of people that go and live in Dubai, but I wouldn't say I'm necessarily always to their taste. They tend to be the sort of people who say, "I'll tell you who was funny then," and then name somebody who I don't have very much in common with. Again, this is not to generalise. I've had some nice times, but I haven't actually been there for years, though. But those are the sort of gigs you go in order to lie in the sun for a few days, I think it's fair to say.
Okay.
Whereas many countries of the world... I mean, it really makes you realise how lucky you are to be an English speaker, really, because, as you say, there are English language gigs you can perform almost anywhere. Hong Kong is a good example.
Yes.
I found myself in some unbelievable places as a result of doing this, and that is one of the huge perks of the job.
So I dare say you're somebody who might have the criticism of the colonialism of the British Empire, but you're very grateful that spread the language around the world to provide you with a career
Absolutely.
To do jokes about.
The best of both worlds,
All right, let's go on. We're going to run out of time, otherwise get on to your fifth wonder, which is, it's back to Australia, I think, the lyrebird.
Yes, actually, I mean, luckily I don't have as much to say about this, but the lyrebird is... But the reason I think this is a wonder is it's a wonder in the most literal sense, which is I just can't really believe that this exists. Mm. And I've not even seen it with my own eyes, despite how much... But a lyrebird is probably most everyone knows is this bird which can impersonate the sounds of other birds, but also other things that it hears. But it's spelt lyre as in the musical instrument.
Yeah.
And yet that must be a pun on being a lyre, classically Australian sort of gag, even within its name. The guys just can't take anything seriously. I made these selections very late last night, and I'd forgotten all about the lyrebird, but then I was reminded of it yesterday because I took the kids to a show, which some people might have seen, called Attenborough and His Animals, where these two absolute nutters replicate the documentaries of David Attenborough. So one of them pretends to be Attenborough and one of them pretends to be all the animals. And it's the sort of thing, watching it as a comedian, you think, bloody hell, I wouldn't do this every day.
What do the animals do? Do they attack each other? Mate with each other?
There's a bit of everything. There's an awful lot of squawking for the girl in it.
Yeah.
I'll leave that to your imagination.
Yes.
And Just two of them. One of them does an uncanny Attenborough impression, and then the other one takes on the forms of many animals. But they were talking about the lyrebird, and then there was quite a moving bit where the lyrebird started to impersonate things like power drills and that were chopping down the forest, and which is, again, has been observed, I believe, that the bird's starting to make the sounds of things which shouldn't be in their habitats. And so there's a brief moment of reflection about... what our intervention has done to these animals. Then it went back to being really silly. I was going to recommend it, but I think it's finished now. But look out for those guys in the future.
Why do we know why they do these things? Because I think normally it's assumed that a male lyrebird will make a noise, have a call to attract the females so that they can reproduce the species. But it's counterproductive if you impersonate another species, because you might get the females of the wrong species. And who wants a power drill to be attracted to? That's the last thing you want.
Precisely. Plus, if animals are anything like us, I don't think being an impressionist is the way to pull. I can think of sexier skills on the market. This is what
fascinates
me. You said
this to John Culshaw at all?
Absolutely not, no. But if I did, he'd say he'd deliver a good put down in someone else's voice.
In your
back
voice,
at me. Yeah, probably
in
my voice, yeah.
Or your Welsh voice.
Yes, actually, probably never insult an impressionist. Yeah. Um, he, Yeah, it's, this is the thing. I don't understand the purpose of this, and I don't know much about it. I mean, you're right though. It'll be something to do with attracting. I mean, if we've all learned one thing from Attenborough, it's almost everything comes down to sex, whatever species you are.
Yes,
it'll be some sort of complex mating stratagem, probably. But yeah, what I like about it partly is you sometimes come across these bonkers things that exist in nature, and it's not clear why, what purpose it serves, apart from God just thinking, it'd be funny if there was a bird that was an impressionist.
Yes.
And so it's a very small wonder, but I love the idea that for no apparent reason, nature or God or whatever has just occasionally gives us one of these quirky things.
I think there's some fish that just the male has to build a load of stuff. And then the female will be attracted by that. But that's there's no further involvement of the stuff.
Exactly. There are loads of these quirks. I mean, sometimes you think they must be just doing it to get on Attenborough shows. pretend to make the noise of a power drill. That guy over there will make you big. He's been doing it for so long, I wouldn't be surprised if animals have started to play up to him.
Well, the spectacular example of that, I may be getting this wrong, but I think this is the case. Nobody had heard of meerkats until David Attenborough did a programme about meerkats.
I didn't know that. He put them on the map.
I think so.
My daughter loves meerkats.
So they then became, they're in Disney films now. They've got their own, they do those endless adverts, those irritating adverts. I can't remember what they advertise anymore.
Well, it's just as well you can't, but I'll tell you, it's a price comparison website, and you're right, it's annoying as hell, but you're right, that's given meerkats even another level of fame.
Yeah.
So, in another generation, I wouldn't have an eight-year-old whose party trip was a meerkat impression.
No.
And yet here we are,
So that was a...
It's funny to think Attenborough's been going for so long, he's essentially created animals himself, is what we say. In a similar vein, there was a news story, there was a tweet a couple of years ago by John Simpson, the veteran newsreader, about how he was on holiday somewhere and basically war had broken out, and I couldn't help tweeting saying he's been in the news for so long, the news builds itself around him now, in the same way that wherever Poirot is, a murder happens.
You've done some adverts as well, haven't you? Was it cider you used to do?
I don't like to boast, Clive, but I not only advertised cider, I was the voice of the Innocent Smoothies rabbit for a while.
Oh, right.
And that's two of my five a day. Yeah. Well, why didn't someone tell me about this?
There you go.
And it was not a cartoon rabbit. It was an actual live-action rabbit. And I didn't tell my mum. So my mum had a strange day where she put the TV on, and apparently she uttered the line, "Chris, I've just heard a rabbit talking with Mark's voice." This is something that would only happen to the mother of a comedian.
Yes, yeah. And are they enjoyable to do ads, or are they, something you get a bit of flack from?
It's there is sometimes a bit. I mean, the cider advert was did get a little bit of criticism from my peers, but on the other hand, it was very well paid. But the dream, of course, is to do what I did with the Innocent thing and just pretend to be a rabbit and be paid for that without ever even appearing on screen.
Yes.
Rob Brydon does it. Awful lot of business like that, and
he also does cruises, doesn't he? He appears to be on a cruise.
Got all sorts of side hustles, and he his voice is worth a lot of money. Without he never,
well, he probably. Well,
does
he's proper Welsh, you see. He can do.
Yes, that's.
He doesn't have to put it on.
That's where the money is. I did a gig with him a couple of years ago, and he said it must have been before COVID, and he said. He was talking about the benefits of what you mentioned, having a studio in your home. He said, "I don't leave the house now." Nice chunk of cash, Sainsbury's advert, don't even get out of your pyjamas. And then he mentioned the amount, and it was absolutely unbelievable.
Yes.
I'm not going to... It's his business, not mine, but Christ almighty. So, in short, when adverts do come along, I do enjoy them.
Well, I think he had quite a lucrative but obscure career for a while, doing lots of voiceovers.
That's the thing.
And then he broke them.
He already was a voice artist, to be fair.
And then he's fantastic in his various... guises now, but I suppose he keeps that going just in case Gavin and Stacey doesn't come back, or would I lie to you, all those other ones.
Would I lie to you? Yes, I might, about a supermarket.
All right, so that's the lyrebird, and so now your next wonder, which is a good one, but it's very all-embracing, because you say all underground and subway systems.
Yes, a lot of people complain about the underground in London, or in general people are quite... Yeah. They regard, and there are some good reasons. I suppose New York one is very dirty, I suppose, and the Paris. But as a rule, I suppose this is rather sort of starry eyed of me, and it cuts against my gloomy persona. But I just think that in general, metro systems, underground trains, are an extraordinary example of human ingenuity.
Yes.
Basically, I just think it's when you stop and think about it, it's quite. Sometimes I'm on in London. I live in London, and I'm on the tube so often that I rarely do think about it. But occasionally, you do think, we're essentially under Buckingham Palace here, and this oughtn't to be possible. When the kids were smaller, we went to the National Transport Museum in London, which I recommend. And I'm not much of a transport buff, but it is fascinating. and you'll see their photos of how they dug these tunnels and did it in the late Victorian times. And really, it's absolutely... I felt the same when the Eurostar was being built, even when I was at school. The idea that it was possible to build a tunnel to France seemed, even now, feels fanciful to me. There's a childlike bit of me that still thinks it's pretty incredible that we can devise and make stuff like trains that go under a city. I think it's, you know, we give ourselves a hard time as humans, but we have come up with some good stuff.
Well, I completely approve of this. I every now and then compile a list of my seven wonders. People always asking me, what are yours then? Which I rather resent, because you know, now you're doing my format. But, but I have, I sometimes...
Get your own podcast.
I put, you know, London Underground on my on list, because it's always been in my life, and it's the map is so beautifully designed.
It's a remarkable piece of work.
But then you're right, there are plenty of other ones. There are 205 cities in 61 countries have a metro system,
which is
extraordinary. Loads of them in China. I think it's 60 or something. I've got it written down here. 44 in China. 44 Chinese cities.
44 cities in China alone that are so vast that they justify having it.
I mean, we could probably here name three or four Chinese cities we think might be big enough, but then there's another 40 after that.
That is extraordinary to think about. Only once have I performed in China, and that was a similar thing. Again, expats, a lot of Americans. And even on that place, that tour we took in, there's Beijing and Shanghai, but also two or three cities that were... incomprehensibly large for cities that most of us haven't even heard of.
Sure.
It's beyond belief. I do think and so with cities like that, it's in fact with a lot of cities, the size of them means that you know, underground travel is almost unavoidable, really. But I do think London's it must be up there with it's so and again, we all grumble about it when we're on it, but really it's the speed with which you can traverse London by a series of tunnels is quite a modern miracle. I think,
love the London Underground, especially now I don't have to pay for it. Because but there's Glasgow's got an underground system, a subway system, and that's all we've got in this country that counters underground in the whole of the UK.
Yeah, Manchester has sort of a metro system, doesn't it? But some cities have trams. But
it didn't count in the article.
No, I guess not. No.
But so do you presumably have been on the Paris one, the New York one? I've been on those, but I've been on the Moscow one, which I know Russia isn't fashionable at the moment, but that apparently is pretty impressive.
I'd love to have done that. Moscow is, and Russia in general, is top of my list of, I don't like to say regrets, because it could still be on, but it would be top of my destinations to visit. I nearly went to Russia a few years ago. Didn't quite work out because the paperwork was immensely complicated, and it does now look as if it was one to not put off.
You were applying from Ukraine, were you?
It must have gone to the bottom of someone's pile. I have been on a few, though, as you say. The New York one is kind of great for how much like a film it is, like sort of dirty and squalid, and instead of the this is Piccadilly Circus, they basically just bark at you. 61st Street, get off! it's absolutely no help.
It's quite hard to follow, you know, which line goes where.
You don't always know which stops it is going to be. There's no please mind the gap. They're just like, are you on the train or are you going home? And then the Tokyo one was... The main thing I remember about Tokyo is stations have an unbelievable number of exits. Like, you know, Old Street in London is regarded as one famously confusing, but it's only got about four or five exits, I think. Yeah. I went to one in Tokyo with... It was at least 20 exits, and I'm surprised I'm not still there.
And written up in Japanese, presumably.
This is the thing. They do give you a bit of a chance. There was some English signage, but even then, I think for an underground fan, the Tokyo one is a stiff challenge, a workout.
You mentioned this in passing in a way. My favourite bit on the underground is you get to Green Park. And there's a sign, maybe an announcement, saying a light here for Buckingham Palace. And I always imagine the Queen travelling on the other. This is where we get off.
Yes, this is us.
even the use of the word "a light," you know, because a lot of foreigners travelling. The word "a light" is never used in ordinary conversation. Off here. A light. The light. Where's the light?
You can see people desperately googling it on their phones. Yes, it's there are certain quirks like that, the way that Old Street always says Moorfields Eye Hospital.
Yes.
And you can't help looking to see whether someone gets on with an eye patch. Yeah, I've been doing that for years. It's not very tasteful, but I've been living in London for 20 years and I've not lost that habit yet.
Well, I've got sad news for you. They're moving Moorfields Eye Hospital. They're closing that building and going somewhere
else. That's a beautiful building.
Yeah, it'll be a hotel or something.
I suppose it'll be a man-made on. That's right.
It was, of course, for many years a sight for sore eyes. But now I know it's an old joke, but it just came. And it was just naturally came, didn't it? I didn't.
It's nearly the end.
I didn't set that up.
If you think Clive Anderson's not got a closer, then you haven't watched a guy before.
We've got, we've got your final wonder, Mark, which is an iPhone. Which you
yes, the reason
you said you did this last night. I have to say, I've done a lot of different people. Some of them send me their seven wonders a week in advance, a month in advance, a couple of days in advance. This came sometime this morning.
Yes,
after you'd woken up.
Yes, after I'd woken up and after I'd sent a text while falling asleep saying, yes, I'm just doing it now. It's fair to say I overstretch myself every fringe, and this is no exception. Yeah. Although all it was sending a text. But I wanted to give it due thought. The iPhone essentially is there as the seventh one to bind together everything we've been talking about. Because
okay.
I'm not much of a tech person, but I do find the possibilities of phones and smart technology absolutely fascinating. And what I think is specifically wonderful about phones is, you know, things like street mapping technology, the way you can now find your way around with a phone,
yes,
or just the way you can call up an image of all of these places we've been talking about. Or
yeah,
basically, I feel as if the world has obviously shrunk in our lifetimes psychically and mentally. And in some ways, that's a shame because we maybe lose some of what's distinct about all the different parts of the world. But I do think it's a remarkable thing and quite a moving thing that, as a world, we are now in constant contact with each other. So iPhone is sort of ultimate modern wonder of the world because it makes all of the other wonders accessible to basically anyone at the press of a button.
And do you find it, as I do, rather surprising how quickly we get used to these things?
Yeah.
You say iPhone, we've only had iPhones for about 10 years. And
yeah,
you can hardly remember a time without having an iPhone.
That's my fault. And absolutely right. And the new show that I'm working on now is partly about this, about the fact that my son is 12 and my daughter's 8, and neither of them has ever lived in a world where this was not common, and that is a very, very big difference conceptually from any other generation ever to live. Although my son now again can imagine living without an iPhone because he lost it this afternoon in the city cafe.
Yes.
And that's not a gag, unfortunately, for both of us. Yes, I do think it is very interesting to ask what will be the effects upon the next generation of having instant everything without ever having known a time without that.
And you have to explain to them that, well, when I was growing up, you made the phone you had was attached to the wall of your house.
Yes. And
so
yet,
when you went out, you had to drag the whole house with you. It was just...
Oh, it was a simpler time, but we were happy.
Yeah. And we have to imply, we made arrangements and we stuck to them. No, we didn't. We made arrangements and we mucked them up, and then we had to spend 3 hours finding where our friends were.
It's absolutely true, yes. In an awful lot of ways, it's made life a lot easier. But as with all innovations, it's also made many other things more complicated.
Can I throw in this a sort of mildly interesting literary oddity, is that Aldous Huxley wrote Brave New World in 1931, and all these sort of futuristic books, people often say, oh, they predicted, you know, Jules Verne predicted landing on the moon, and they get so many, fiction gets so many things right. In Brave New World, there's a scene when they're flying around in, you know, and it's set in like 500 years' time, they're flying around the Antarctic, and they have to stop their spacecraft, park it, go in, check into a hotel, in order to make a phone call from a phone booth. So Aldous Huxley had not predicted. And why should he? I mean,
he thought that in 500 years you'd still be saying, you haven't got 20p, have you?
So iPhone, so that's a wonder of the world. And of course, the wonder of it is you can pack... Do you know how it works? How do you get all the computing power that took people to the moon and back is now available to us, so we can find where the nearest pret-a-manger is?
Yeah,
somebody,
I think it was Arthur C. Clarke, there's some quote like, any technology sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic. And that's how I feel about the iPhone or any of these things. I'm not technologically minded, I've got no idea how these things work, but it is true, we do live in an age where... of things that ought to be magical to us,
yes,
but aren't always.
And you get some information that takes 10 seconds that would have taken you 3 years to
research.
And now it's a 10-minute delay because there's some problem with your Wi-Fi. Oh, what's going on here? This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Why can't they sort this out?
I felt as if, you know, you thought you were waiting for me to send this list and we were cutting it fine, but a few years ago I've had to write you a letter with this in. My dear Clive, I hope this finds you well.
You might as well have done, Mark, the lateness.
I didn't know what your PO box number was.
Look, we've come to an end. We've overrun already. Even if people are enjoying our conversation,
they won't want a 24-hour long one.
If they are, they've got to go and do other things. So, Mark Watson, thank you for sharing your.
Thanks for inviting me. It's been really enjoyable. Thank you.
Yes.
Thanks so much for listening.
A bit more. Now I have to choose the wonder of wonders from your list of seven, the one which struck me as particularly wonderful as you described it in this podcast. And, this is quite a hard one. I think it's one of the wonders I'd like to see included sometime, I'm going to make all underground and subway systems your wonder of wonders, because that's one I prefer. So, once again, a round of applause please for Mark Watson.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode of My Seven Wonders, it would be wonderful if you could rate and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you found us. Thank you for listening.
My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production in association with Alaska TV and powered by the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.